You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected works, volume number 165 by Rudolf Steiner, 13 lectures entitled Unifying Humanity Spiritually Through the Christ Impulse. Translated by Christian von Arnim. This is lecture 9, given in Dornach on the 6th of January 1916. It rests with me to say something about the differences in the way of thinking and conception between our fifth post-Atlantean epoch and the fourth post-Atlantean epoch. Specifically, I wish to indicate today which elements of thinking and perception have changed a great deal from the one period, the one cycle, into the other cycle. And I wish to show specifically to what extent certain ways of conception and perception have descended to a deeper sphere, as it were, in order then to show what in particular is required in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, the one we are in ourselves, so that humanity can start to ascend once again. Now I have long tried to investigate how the matter can be presented in the clearest way, and want to try today, on the basis of those investigations, to present the matter in a pictorial way. For this reason, I want to start by telling you a number of things in, let us say, a kind of novelistic form, which I have compiled. The story I want to tell is of a family which lived in the not-too-distant past and was close to another family. And, because all kinds of events in the one family were of great interest and importance to a member of the other family, the member of the other family tried to get to the bottom of these events. Let us assume that there was a young girl in the first family. As I said, the matter already lies a little in the past, who was still some way away from entering her 20s. The father of this girl was a soldier, and the time which we are specifically looking at was in advance of a bigger war which the father of the girl had to fight in. But the girl was virtually engaged to another soldier, who also had to go to war, and she was very fond of him, so that she was deeply unhappy that he had to go to war. And as she thought that her father had been partly responsible for the outbreak of the war, resentment toward her father built up inside her, although she gave no outward sign of it. And the more the time approached, the more the thoughts and feelings of this young girl became confused. She could not bear losing her beloved. And because these feelings were so deep-seated, her image of her father became totally distorted. Her anger kept growing. The war came. But what had taken hold of the soul of the young girl kept expanding into a kind of confusion of soul, the kind of confusion of soul which doctors today diagnose as mental illness. And so, as war broke out, this young girl had all kinds of experiences of a kind which were close to mental illness, visions and similar things. She had one strong vision in particular. Her beloved would be killed in the war, and everything that she would have been able to do in the world, in association with her beloved, would become impossible with his death. And she would actually become a victim of war with all her intentions. The mental illness kept growing. It got to the stage that the doctors found it best to take her far away to the country, where she was well looked after and where she was also able to do things which were beneficial through a certain manner of the souls around her, as can happen with people who suffer from that kind of illness. But there was no hope that the full extent of the mental illness might not emerge again if she were removed from these circumstances and placed somewhere else. And so she spent many years there. The war had long finished, and other awful things had happened in the family, which I do not want to discuss in detail here. All kinds of awful things, which included that after a good number of years, the brother of this girl was also affected by mental illness. Now the peculiar thing happened that following various other decisions, the brother who had transformed the girl's mental illness into male form was taken by wise people to the place where the girl was. And, lo and behold, it happened strangely that the brother, although he was also considered to be mentally ill, had a positive effect on the girl. In the loneliness which she suffered among the other people, they had nevertheless met their surroundings, recognized one another, although they had not seen each other for many years, and caused each other to return to health. So the girl was able to return home and founded a kind of refuge, which was organized in such a way that ill people of the kind which the two of them had been could be mentally healed through an understanding of the reasons for the illness. The refuge she founded had a deeply religious character. Now, I said that another family was close to the family in which these events had occurred. A member of the other family was very interested in these remarkable events and said, "We have to investigate this strange case. The events which I now tell must be thought of as lying only a few years back." He therefore approached a medical scientist, a physician, whom he knew, and who called himself a psychopathologist, because he pursued psychopathology. Let us call this psychopathologist Luvius, Professor Dr. Luvius. He began by telling the doctor what he knew about the two children, about the way the girl's illness had come about through her resentment against her father, how he had been able to observe her, what he had seen of the affair. Professor Dr. Luvius listened attentively, made a deeply serious face, reflected profoundly, and said, That must, to a great extent, be due to an hereditary affliction. That is undoubtedly an hereditary affliction. We are dealing with an hereditary affliction. We have to look carefully in the family papers, have to look at everything in detail. And, lo and behold, a whole lot of material was collected from the family papers. It happily turned out that the characteristics, the qualities of previous generations could be investigated as far back as the grandfather, the great-grandfather, and even the great-great-grandfather. Professor Dr. Luvius studied this case for a long time, and he increasingly found confirmation that this was an extraordinary case of a hereditary affliction, as it is called. Indeed, a typical case of an hereditary affliction, a textbook case of an exceptional kind. Professor Dr. Luvius, who had already investigated the psychopathy of Conrad Ferdinand Meyer, Victor Scheffel, Hebel, and others, found this textbook case exceptionally interesting and collected all the data which could explain such a textbook case. Let us begin by trying to follow the man diagrammatically. From what we know about the case, we are to begin with dealing with the daughter of the soldier and her brother. Those are the two individuals to begin with. If we go further back, we come to the father. Professor Dr. Luvius began by setting his sights on the father, found that there was something extraordinarily violent in his character, and that he was a very ambitious man, but also a man with a great deal of initiative. He had characteristics which could be found again in his brother, as characteristics which had been transformed into strengths. We have to look at the whole family structure in these cases. Only here they were present in a much more benign form, a weaker form. But the father of the two siblings was a highly ambitious man with exceptional initiative. Such excessive ambition, drive, also a certain resistance against the world, must of course be traced back further in the family, So the father of the father was looked at. Thus we come to the father of the father, who in turn had a brother. There we find the extraordinarily interesting fact that the brothers, through two generations, had certain similarities and differences. Because here there was the father of the father, that is, the grandfather of our young girl, who, while the father was only an exaggeratedly ambitious and energetic man, was already a kind of violent man. That characteristic had weakened in the father. But the brother was a type of man who was almost pathological in his kindness, almost abnormal. They were both abnormal in the earlier generation, that is, the similarity. But the one through violence and the other through kindness. And then Professor Dr. Luvius discovered that the violent man, that is, the grandfather of our young girl, was always out to cause dissent and mischief in his brother's family. And Professor Dr. Luvius concluded that this violent man really did manage, we are dealing with the grandfather here, to completely ruin the sons of his brother. He turned the one into a gambler, and he ensnared the other one in another way. In short, he thoroughly ruined his brother's sons. That is what could be learned from the family papers. All kinds of bad things had happened. Not everything was altogether clear, but this was certain. The man finally behaved in such a way toward his brother, the other man, that actually the whole family, all the sons, degenerated, and only one remained, who decided to revenge his father on the brother. But this act of revenge, in turn, brought misfortune on the families, namely into the family of the father of our girl. All kinds of unfortunate events happened. And now, Professor Dr. Luvius said to himself, we have to go even further back in the line of descent, because this young girl had quite strange visions at the start of her madness. She kept dreaming about far distant regions where she had never been as a girl, but which had a strange resemblance to a certain locality. Professor Dr. Luvius discovered in a family diary that something lived in these visions of the region in which the great-grandfather and the great-great-grandfather had once lived. Oh, said Professor Dr. Luvius, this is a particularly interesting textbook case. Here heredity crops up in her thinking as visions. Great-great and great-grandfather came from another region than the one in which their descendants ended up living. And the experiences of earlier generations had been passed down the line of heredity in such a way that the great-grandfather or great-great-granddaughter, great-granddaughter or great-great-granddaughter had visions about it in her madness. That was something exceptionally interesting for the professor, of course. So he discovered that the grandfather, in turn, had a father who, as I said, according to an old family diary, had emigrated from a quite different foreign region where the culture was very different. I won't name any locality because that is so unpleasant at the moment. Nations are fighting one another, and if we now name localities, that immediately arouses feelings. So, the great-grandfather and the great-great-grandfather came from a foreign region. Well, the diary revealed that the great-grandfather was also a strange man. He had done all kinds of mad things in this remote region, was also a violent man who sometimes fell into violent rages. As he had committed all kinds of things in his violent rage, he could not stay in the region. He had to emigrate and went to the region where the descendants were. But he also caused trouble in the region where the descendants were, although later he became a very well-respected man. In the region where his descendants were, he had caused trouble simply because he was in love with a woman, and when her father refused to permit him to marry her, he killed the father in a duel. That is how he obtained the daughter. The affair was swept under the carpet, as we say, and he was able to become a respected man. Now, thanks to the family register, Professor Dr. Livius was able to get as far as the great-great-grandfather. And this great-great-grandfather was an especially strange man. He lived in a very exotic region. He was a person who had obtained a kind of deeper insight into the secrets of history. He was a spiritual person. But, said Professor Dr. Livius, someone who exaggerates the spiritual to such an extent as the great-great-grandfather has done, is not quite right in the head in any case. And when he researched further in the family papers, he also found that this great-great-grandfather had retained certain human characteristics despite his thorough knowledge of spiritual things. Above all, he could not stand anyone who had obtained spiritual knowledge in some other way than his own. They were a thorn in his flesh. And playing a trick on them was something which he saw almost as being a spiritual delicacy. What I am relating now is an event which already goes back approximately to the 1760s. But things keep repeating themselves. Edward von Hartmann subsequently did something similar with the Philistine people of the 19th century, something I have often talked about. This great-great-grandfather once published a kind of work, he did not put his name to it, but published it anonymously, in which he thoroughly refuted everything contained in his own teaching. He presented everything as confused and stupid and foolish, and always in such a way that the others could take great pleasure in it, because he always used their arguments, the kind of things they might have said. These were tasty morsels for the others. He played a great trick on them by doing that. So Professor Dr. Livius said to himself, "Well, it is all very obvious. Even in the time of the great-great-grandfather, we can see at work in the line of heredity what has come to such terrible expression in the descendants. Even the good side of the great-great-grandfather, his spiritual gifts, appear again in his great-great-granddaughter, who founded a kind of spiritual refuge. We can see that all the good and bad characteristics in this textbook case are, quote, hereditary afflictions, close quote, to the greatest extent." So Professor Livius was extremely interested in this story. He had, of course, decided to write a fat book about this typical textbook case, and on one occasion explained it to a colleague. And, as it happened, someone was listening on this occasion who did not really want to, but could not avoid hearing it. Someone who not only had a knowledge of the human being, but who also had cosmic knowledge relating to the development of humanity. That person listened, and all kinds of thoughts came to him while Professor Dr. Livius recounted his case. So let me present a version of these thoughts to you. The actual version is not very important. While always building on this family tree, on the family tree of Professor Dr. Livius's textbook case. So the following thoughts came to the person. There was once a respected family in the course of human development. The fate of the founder of this family, Tantalus, who had to suffer punishment in Tartarus, is well known. He is initiated into the secrets of the gods. The Greeks give expression to it by saying that a person who is initiated into the secrets of the gods may eat at their table. But there was something in him which spurred him on, which made it like a delicacy for him to deceive the gods, the officially recognized gods. And so, you know the story, he served up his son, whom he had cut into pieces, as a delicacy for the gods. And the gods, who committed an error in their omniscience, ate of it, and also drank of the blood. As punishment, Tantalus was thrown into Tartarus, where he had to suffer the torments of Tantalus, which are related in the Greek myths. Through a series of crimes which occurred from one generation to the next, the revenge of the gods was passed down to the last descendant. To begin with, Pelops, the son of Tantalus, was thrown out of heaven, where he had been taken by the gods. He wandered through Asia Minor to Greece and won Hippodamia as his wife by vanquishing her father. This is the thought which came to the listener when he heard the story Professor Dr. Luvius was telling, namely, that the former had a duel with the father and obtained his wife in that way. The grace of heaven had by no means yet been withdrawn, as his luck proved. But soon he made himself so unworthy of this grace through various actions that the blessing departed from his house. His marriage with Hippodamia produced two sons, Atreus and Thyestes, who fled to Argos, guilty of murder, where they inherited the throne of this kingdom from their cousin Eurystheus. There the siblings committed new atrocities, so that the royal palace of Mycenae was the scene of a blood feud which from child to child destroyed each generation of both families. The worst crime was the so-called meal of Thyestes, for Atreus, who had learned that his wife had been seduced by Thyestes, invited the latter and his two sons to a banquet. Conscious of his guilt, Thyestes followed the lure and came to the banquet. This reminded this person, who knew something about human nature, very much of the dispute between the grandfather and his brother, who had lured his sons away and got them into all kinds of trouble which led them to perish, as the family paper said. The atrocity happened. Atreus served up for this brother his secretly slaughtered pair of sons. The latter drank from the blood. That, too, is really an, in quotes, hereditary affliction. Ancient Tantalus had already done that to the gods. Now the grandson was doing it. This was a crime from which Apollo turned the steeds of his son chariot away with a shudder when he looked down on Mycenae. They were revenged by a son of Thyestes, who was born later on, called Aegisthus. Aegisthus told about the hideous deed, first killed his uncle Atreus, and then also lay in wait for his children. Atreus had two sons with his wife Europa, Agamemnon and Menelaus, called the Atridaea, or sons of Atreus. Aegisthus, the last son of Thyestes, hatched treacherous plans of revenge toward them. But he could not break cover until the two related brothers had undertaken the great campaign of Troy. Once they had departed, he knew how to beguile the passionate queen, Clytemnestra. Clytemnestra had borne her husband three daughters and one son. The daughter in which we are mainly interested is called Iphigenia, and the son Orestes. Iphigenia, the eldest daughter, was sacrificed on the altar of Artemis, of Diana, because this goddess had greatly taken against the departing Greeks and had to be modified with the daughter. The mother hated her husband and responded to the thoughts of murder whispered in her ear. Now we know that Iphigenia was removed to Taurus and awoke in the grounds of the temple. We know that she was taken to a rural area, an environment in which she was harmless, a fate similar to the one of our great-great-granddaughter. We do not need to go into the further events in the family, but now the myth still records the following. After Orestes had found his daughter Iphigenia again in Taurus, and she had healed him of his madness, he took her to Greece. Then the story further relates that Iphigenia, when she returned to Greece, established a kind of oracle, a sacrificial site for Diana of Taurus, which, translated into Greek circumstances, would be roughly the same as when someone now established a kind of refuge for ill people, in accordance with the kind of spiritual scientific principles that I have mentioned. All I wanted to say with that is that we can imagine a similar process in ancient Greece and in modern times. It happens whatever the times, because you can see that the process from the 18th and 19th centuries, which I related first, could have occurred exactly as I related it. No one will be able to cast doubt on the smallest detail. Neither will anyone be able to cast doubt on all the trappings I developed. But there is nevertheless a certain difference, namely the way we feel about this case, how we think about it. We have seen how in the 19th, 20th century, Professor Loewius reached the conclusion, hereditary affliction, textbook case. The Greeks said to themselves, when something like that happens, such an event expresses precisely the deeper forces at work in the history of humanity, and they turn it into myths. There was no Professor Dr. Loewius in ancient Greece, but there was a poet who, in a deeper sense, understood these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 generations, and there's a diagram, and wrote a poetic work about them, which poets continue to use as inspiration up to and including Goethe's wonderful Iphigenia, titled Iphigenia. And the difference isn't even that great, because, just consider, you only need to take one of the psychological or psychiatric books to hand by one of the many scientists which deal with psychology and spiritual forces. You will find that all of them say the following. The healthy person as such is exceptionally difficult to study in his mental characteristics. But at the sick bed and in hospital and through the departments of psychiatry, a lot can also be learned about the normal course of the healthy soul, and a great many conclusions about the healthy soul are drawn from the sick soul. I only remind you that, for example, the speech center, the location in which speech is concentrated, was thought to have been found by studying it in sick people lacking the power of speech. So people say to themselves, we can learn about how health works from that which is not in order. If we imagine these things not in the 19th century, but in the language of the Greeks, it would sound like this. If we want to know about the forces at work in the progression of human development, we must not go to the people and study them who only display their healthy side in their soul life and all that they are. But we have to go to all kinds of people who have abnormal characteristics in relation to what is normal. How the Greeks became what they are, that is, what the Greek poets sought to understand, and at the same time, in a certain sense, they were all sages, because wisdom and beauty were connected with one another. Thus it happened that these Greek poets presented the destiny of the Greeks in these abnormal generations. But the Greeks took a more differentiated view. The great difference between what Professor Dr. Loewius says and what the Greeks said is that the Greeks knew something about the secrets of the human soul. There is a great difference between what awakens in the soul through the extraordinary myth of the Atridae, Iphigenia, Tantalus, and Pelops, and everything that arises in our soul as ideas when we hear the bespectacled Professor Dr. Loewius, who says, quote, it's all hereditary affliction, close quote, because hereditary affliction is what makes the textbook case in every shape and form in accordance with modern science, in accordance with the knowledge of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. That is where the difference lies to a person who is still fully immersed in the culture of ancient Greece. Imagine a Greek who wanted to describe how Iphigenia, after she had experienced what the Greek told about events in Aulis, was removed to a foreign land, to Taurus, experienced being reunited with Orestes there, and so on. Imagine what that Greek would have told. Think how that is taken up again in Goethe's Iphigenia. Put yourself in the moment when King Thoas and Taurus stands before Iphigenia in Goethe's work, where he woos Iphigenia, and where Iphigenia feels obliged to speak the words, quote, behold, I am of Tantalus's house, close quote. Quote again, calmly you speak momentous words, close quote. The whole of Greek culture comes to life again in what the Greek, or the resurrected Greek, had to say in the context of such a soul life. Quote, I am of Tantalus's house. Close quote. And then it seems, after those words have been spoken, as if Professor Dr. Loewius appears giggling at a small window screen. Quote, he, hereditary affliction. Close quote. There you have the difference in its entirety between what was presented by the fourth post-Atlantean epoch and what the fifth, our post-Atlantean epoch, has to offer. Because the two things may indeed be compared. I have not exaggerated in the slightest, but only given a very factual account. The two things may be compared with one another, and that is so because the composition of the Greek myth, the meaning of the Greek myth, has been replaced by the teaching of hereditary affliction, even in literature. After all, we only need to compare Sophocles or Aeschylus with Ibsen, and we have exactly the same contrast in literature, with the difference that, for the Greeks, science and literature did not diverge in this way. You only need to read what I have said about the mysteries and the origins of art and religion in the mysteries to understand that there was neither a Greek Ibsen nor a Greek Professor Dr. Loewius. They would both be one and the same. But they would be the ones who composed the myth, that which, as myth, contained the truth. Because health, the physician's skill, the skill of Mercury with his staff, that was not presented in ancient Greece in any form other than in stories, just like the story of Tantalus's house and Iphigenia. It was not customary at that time to speak in abstract terms, but in images. And images were used to present the truth. And the things which filled Greek soul life, which completely organized the Greek soul inwardly, relate to the things which today are accepted as truth, as the archetypal character of truth, in the way that, quote, behold, I am of Tantalus's house, close quote, relates to, quote, he, hereditary affliction, close quote. It is this, my dear friends, which we should inscribe in our souls, in our soul, about something that has descended from the culture of ancient Greece to the present day on a downward path. It can give us an indication of the things that need to be developed if we are to start ascending again. That would take us too far today. I will continue these reflections tomorrow for those who will still want to hear them. The end of Lecture 9.